Macmillan Audio presents The Other Bennett Sister, written by Janice Hadlow, read by Carla Mendonca. Part 1. Chapter 1. It is a sad fact of life that if a young woman is unlucky enough to come into the world without expectations, she had better do all she can to ensure she is born beautiful. To be poor and handsome is misfortune enough, but to be penniless and plain is a hard fate indeed. Four of the five Bennet sisters of Meryton in Hertfordshire had sensibly provided themselves with good looks enough to be accounted beauties in the limited circles in which they moved. Jane, the eldest, was the most striking. The charms of her face and figure enhanced by the unassuming modesty of her character. Elizabeth, the second sister, made up in wit and liveliness for any small deficiencies in her appearance, whilst Catherine and Lydia, the two youngest, exhibited all the freshness of youth, accompanied by a taste for laughter and flirtation, which recommended them greatly to young men of equally loud and undiscriminating inclinations. Only Mary, the middle daughter, possessed neither beauty, wit, nor charm. But her sisters shone so brightly that they seemed to cancel out her failure, and indeed eclipse her presence altogether, so that by the time they were grown, the Bennet family was regarded as one of the most pleasing in the neighbourhood. It was common knowledge, however, that the Bennet girls' prospects were to be envied a great deal less than their beauty. At first sight, the family appeared prosperous enough. They were the principal inhabitants of the village of Longbourn, and their house, solid and unremarkable as it was, made up in comfort what it lacked in pretension. There were servants to wait at table, a cook in the kitchen, and a man to tend the gardens. And though Mr. Bennet's possessions were not extensive, they were quite enough to sustain his credit as a private gentleman. Few of the families with whom they were intimate were sufficiently rich or genteel to condescend to them with confidence, and the Bennets were regarded, in public at least, as eminently respectable ornaments to Hertfordshire society. But in the country, no family's business is ever truly its own, and everyone knew that the outward prosperity of the Bennets rested on very uncertain foundations. Their property was subject to an entail, which restricted inheritance to male heirs. If no Bennet's son was produced, the estate would pass eventually into the hands of Mr. Bennet's cousin. At first, this had seemed of little significance. As baby after baby arrived at Longbourn with promising regularity, surely it was only a matter of time before the much-anticipated Bennet boy put in his overdue appearance. But when the tally of girls reached five, and it was clear no more children could be expected, the entail cast a deepening shadow over the family's happiness. On Mr. Bennet's death, his widow and daughters would be left with nothing but £5,000 in the 4%, and a humiliating dependence on the uncertain charity of a distant and unknown relative. Their friends were not without sympathy for the Bennet's plight, but that did nothing to dampen their curiosity about what was to come. For what could be more compelling than to watch at first hand the probable wreck and dissolution of an entire family's fortune? Mr. Bennet refused to gratify his neighbours by displaying any obvious disappointment at the cruel trick of fate which had deprived his dependents of the security he had once so confidently expected them to enjoy. To the world at large, he remained what he had always been, detached, amused, and apparently resigned to an outcome it was not in his power to change. To his family themselves, he seemed barely more concerned. Perhaps in the long hours he spent in his library, he wrestled with himself to find an answer to their plight. If so, he shared neither his anxieties nor his conclusions with them. His wife, however, had none of his restraint. Mrs. Bennet thought of little else but the hardships which lay in store for herself and her daughters when Mr. Bennet was dead, and she was often to be heard lamenting the wickedness of the entail both at home and abroad. Her nerves, she declared, were not equal to the strain placed upon them by such an unfortunate business. How anyone could have had the conscience to entail away an estate from their daughters she did not profess to understand. But unless something was done about it, ruin must engulf them all. She was a woman of no great intelligence and small imagination, but she possessed considerable powers of energy and application, which she devoted with all the tenacity at her command to finding a solution to their predicament. She was soon persuaded that there was only one answer to the miserable situation in which her girls were placed. They must marry as quickly and as advantageously as possible. If their father could not secure his daughter's futures, they must look to a husband to do so. To have seen her daughters married to men of merely respectable means would have soothed away many of Mrs. Bennet's anxieties. But to imagine them united to husbands of ample income and substantial property was for her a joy undimmed by frequent contemplation. Nothing made her happier than to think of them in possession of elegant houses and rolling parkland, certain of never hearing the dreaded word entail again. She was aware, of course, that wealthy men in want of wives were not easy to find, and harder still to catch, especially by girls without large dowries, but she was undaunted. Her daughters, she believed, possessed an advantage that would enable them to triumph over all difficulties. Other girls might be rich, but her daughters were beautiful. This, she was sure, was the blessing that would deliver them into wealth. Their looks would attract men of the first eligibility, dazzling their eyes, winning their hearts, and persuading them to ignore the promptings of cold, mercenary common sense. It was, for Mrs. Bennet, an article of faith that, in the absence of £10,000 in the hand, a pretty face was the single most valuable asset a young woman could possess. Her own experience confirmed her opinion, for, some 25 years before, it had been Mrs. Bennet's youthful beauty which had swept a besotted Mr. Bennet to the altar, overcoming all obstacles that appeared to stand in the way of their union. As he gazed on her handsome face, it had meant nothing to him that her father was merely a country attorney who kept an office in Meryton, or that her brother lived within sight of his own warehouses in Cheapside. He had been determined to marry her, and against all advice to the contrary, he had done so. On the whole, Mrs. Bennet considered herself well satisfied with the outcome. It was true that Mr. Bennet was a whimsical man who teased her more than she thought proper, but as mistress of Longbourn, she presided over a property large enough to gratify her vanity, whilst her husband's rank assured her the pleasure of patronising her less fortunate acquaintances on every possible occasion. For Mr. Bennet, however, the benefits of his marriage were far less apparent. His failure to consider whether his spouse's character was likely to bring him as much pleasure as her appearance had more serious and lasting consequences. The shallowness of Mrs. Bennet's mind and the limited nature of her interests meant theirs could never be a partnership of equals. She could be neither his companion nor his friend. Her beauty had been enough to win him, but, as Mr. Bennet soon understood, it was not enough to make him happy. Fortunately for Mrs. Bennet, she was not a reflective woman, and if her husband now regretted the principles on which he had made his choice of a wife, she remained oblivious of this fact. As a result, her prejudices survived unchallenged. She esteemed no qualities of female character other than beauty. Wit and intellect, kindness and good humour mattered not at all to her. Good looks trumped every other attribute. In her daughters, she valued nothing so much as their power to please. With 4 of her girls, Mrs. Bennet had, in this respect, every reason to be satisfied. Of Jane, she entertained the highest possible hopes, for, as she frequently observed to Mr. Bennet, she was sure she could not have been born so beautiful for nothing. 3 further sisters, if not quite as generously blessed as Jane, were still, in Mrs. Bennet's opinion, sufficiently distinguished to attract notice wherever they went. Only 1 of her daughters had failed her. Mary had made the mistake of inheriting neither the looks nor the charm shared by all other female members of the Bennet family. This was a sin for which, in Mrs. Bennet's eyes, there could be no forgiveness, as Mary herself had quickly discovered. Chapter 2. Mary could not remember exactly when she had discovered she was plain. She did not think that she had known it when, as a very little girl, she had played happily with Jane and Elizabeth, running around the garden with grass stains on her dress, or when they had huddled together before the nursery fire, warming their feet on the fender. She did not think she had known it when Mrs. Hill, her mother's housekeeper, had washed her face every morning and tied a clean pinafore over her dress. She had certainly not known it when she and her elder sisters had rushed into the kitchen on baking days, begging for a crust of warm bread which they would carry away and eat together behind the shrubbery, laughing as if they would never stop. Then, she thought, she had been happy. But by the time she was 7 or 8 years old, she had begun to suspect something was not quite right. She saw that her mother often looked at her with an expression she did not direct at Jane or Lizzie. It was something between irritation and puzzlement. Mary was not quite sure which, but she came to recognize it very well. A summons always followed.
"Come here, child, and let me look at you."
Mary would get down from her chair and walk across the drawing room to where Mrs. Bennet sat, uneasy under her mother's scrutiny. Her hair ribbons would be tweaked, her sash retied, and her dress pulled this way and that. But whatever it was that bothered Mrs. Bennet, none of the attempts to correct it ever satisfied. She pursed her lips and looked away frustrated, speechlessly waving her daughter back to her place. Mary knew she had disappointed her mother, even if she did not yet know in what way she had failed. But she was a clever girl, and she soon understood what the sighs and frowns and dismissals meant. She could not help but notice that Mrs. Bennet never talked about her appearance with the pleasure with which she described her elder sisters.
"Jane is as lovely as an angel,"
her mother often declared, regarding her eldest daughter with transparent pride.
"It is a pleasure just to gaze at her."
Jane would hang her head, for she was a modest girl, and compliments made her blush. She would not look at Elizabeth, who, when Mrs. Bennet's preening grew excessive, would catch her sister's eye and try to make her laugh. Elizabeth's own appearance was not quite so much to her mother's taste as Jane's. Her dark eyes and sparkling smile were too suggestive of her lively character to win Mrs. Bennet's wholehearted approval. She was too amused with the world to qualify as a true beauty, but for all her misgivings, Mrs. Bennet's appraising eye acknowledged there was something about Lizzie that appealed. Whilst she often scolded her second daughter for the pertness of her remarks and the independence of her spirit, she did not complain of her looks. As she grew older, Mary waited hopefully for Mrs. Bennet to bestow similar words of appreciation upon her. At first, she imagined her mother's approval would come naturally with time, that she would reach an age when she too would bask in her admiration. But even when she paid extra attention to herself, making sure that her stockings were straight, her face was clean, and her hair well brushed, still her mother had no kind word to offer her. Month after month she waited, anxiously anticipating the moment when Mrs. Bennet would find something about her to praise. Perhaps her eyes might be considered fine, or her figure graceful. Perhaps her hair might be her best feature. She did not mind which part of her Mrs. Bennet thought worthy of notice. Anything would do, as long as it allowed her the chance to take her place amongst her sisters in the glow of their mother's approval. Mary was 10 when she understood this would never happen. It was a warm afternoon. Mrs. Bennet was taking tea with her sister, Mrs. Phillips. Jane and Lizzie had vanished at the sound of their aunt's arrival, leaving Mary alone, perched on the sofa, twisting the ends of her hair in her hands, wishing desperately to be somewhere else. Neither her mother nor her aunt paid her any attention. Their conversation rambled on, raging from the likelihood of Lady Lucas's cook leaving her,
and just before the bottling season, too,
to the probability of the vicar's wife being brought to bed this very week. But when Mrs. Phillips dropped her voice to a whisper and leant forward to impart a particularly choice piece of gossip, Mrs. Bennet was suddenly alert to her daughter's presence.
"Mary, go down to the kitchen and bring up some more sugar. Take the bowl. Now, please."
Delighted to be released, Mary lingered as long as she could on her errand, dawdling back along the hall, kicking her shoes against the flagstones to see how much dust she could raise. At the door to the morning room, she stopped to smooth down her dress when, emerging from the low murmur of conversation, she heard her own name pronounced. She knew she should declare herself. Mrs. Hill had often told her that listeners never heard good about themselves, but she found it impossible to draw away.
I think Mary is in better looks today, remarked Mrs. Phillips. A little less pale than usual.
Mrs. Bennet sniffed.
It's kind of you to say so, sister, but I'm afraid I can't agree. For so young a girl, she has no bloom at all. Not like Jane and Lizzie. Their bloom is always very much remarked upon.
Oh, indeed, they are very pleasing, agreed Mrs. Phillips obligingly. And I doubt that Mary will ever be admired as they are. But, sister, I wonder if you aren't rather harsh in judging her as you do. Perhaps she suffers by comparisons. If Jane and Lizzie were a little less handsome, then she might seem prettier in your eyes.
I wish with all my heart you were right, but I'm afraid comparisons don't come into it. Mary is simply very plain, and that's that. I blame Mr. Bennet's side of the family. We gardeners have always been remarkable for our appearance.
Mrs. Phillips topped up her tea and looked for the sugar bowl.
Well, I'm very sorry for the girl. It cannot be easy to be the only ugly duckling amongst so many swans.
Yes, it is a great disappointment to me, and excessively bad for my nerves. But I find that once I look at my other daughters, I soon feel better. Oh, where has she got to with the sugar?
Mary edged into the room, her eyes on the floor. Her fingers were clenched very tightly round the sugar bowl as she placed it on the table. Her aunt smiled at her, but Mrs. Bennet paid no attention as she slipped away. In the hall, her heart beat hard in her chest. She felt her mother's words with as much force as if they had been a blow. So now she knew, she thought, as she walked upstairs. Now she understood. She was plain, like a boiled potato, a length of unbleached calico, a flat white dinner plate. She walked into her bedroom, pulled the chair towards her dressing table, and placed her face as close as she could to the little mirror. The glass was old and tarnished, but provided enough reflection for Mary to see herself clearly within it. A small face looked back at her, round and pale. Yes, she thought, a dinner plate. Her grey eyes under light eyebrows were neither large and blue like Jane's nor dark and lively like Lizzie's. Her features were regular enough, but they were not distinguished. Her mouth was narrow, her lips thin. There was an anxious look about her, she decided. Her face did not suggest, as Lizzie's did, that she might break into laughter at any time. Her hair was a light brown. It was not gold and shining as Jane's was. There was nothing about her, she concluded, that demanded attention or that would make anyone look upon her with pleasure. Her mother was right. She neither glowed nor bloomed. For a while she stared at the mirror, still hoping to find some bright feature, some hidden asset that might redeem her. When she found nothing, she picked up the shawl that lay hanging on the back of her chair and draped it carefully over the mirror. A single tear trickled down her face, which she did not trouble to wipe away. Mary said nothing to Jane or Lizzie about what she had heard. She supposed they knew already. Her plainness now seemed so obvious that she did not know how she had not seen it herself. She did not expect them to show her any sympathy. They would never understand how she felt. How could they? Their beauty was as much a part of them as an arm or leg. It was impossible for them to imagine life without it. Under its protection, they would leap and spring and dance into their futures. She, on the other hand, would trudge stolidly forward, placing one foot in front of the other without joy or grace. She had learned from Mrs. Bennet that without beauty, no real and lasting happiness was attainable. It never occurred to her to question what she'd been taught. She had always been a cautious, watchful girl. Now she thought of little else but the poor impression she must make upon those around her. The high spirits that had once inspired her to play and run about with her sisters ebbed away. She no longer had the heart for it. When Jane and Lizzie romped together or raced about the garden, everyone smiled and said they looked charming. But Mary told herself that if she were to do the same, she would appear ridiculous. It did not seem fitting for her to be light-hearted. Seriousness seemed the only mood a plain girl might adopt without exposing herself to the scorn or pity of others. Gradually, she became used to it, until she came to believe that it was her nature, that this solemn, solitary, awkward creature was really who she was. She watched with sadness as Jane and Lizzie drifted steadily away from her. They gave up their attempt to include her, rebuffed by her unhappiness. Mary was not surprised. Of course they preferred each other. How could they not? It was not long before they formed a tight, impregnable partnership, shored up by shared confidences and whispered asides. Mary could hardly believe there had ever been room for another sister in their affections, let alone herself. She bore the loss of Jane philosophically. For all Jane's sweetness, Mary had always found her a remote presence, unknowable behind her perfect face. But the gulf that had opened up between herself and Elizabeth caused her real pain. It was only as they drew apart that Mary realized how much she loved her, how much she had reveled in her lively presence. No one could make you laugh as Lizzie could, tease you into happiness, coax you into smiling at yourself with such easy charm. For a while, Mary clung on to a hope that Lizzie would be the one to save her, that she would recognize her sadness and extend her hand to help her, pulling her out of the pit of misery into which she felt she was slowly sinking. But although Lizzie sometimes looked at Mary with puzzlement, sometimes almost with regret, she neither spoke nor acted to keep her near, and soon their old closeness was nothing more than a memory. As her elder sisters retreated from her, Mary had wondered whether she might not find a friend in one of the younger girls. When they were small, she watched them keenly, trying to see if they had inherited Jane's and Lizzie's beauty. She did not like to admit what it was that she hoped for. It seemed a cruel thing to wish that a chubby toddler might not grow into a fine young girl. But Mary could not help it. If either Kitty or Lydia turned out to be plain, then she might not feel so alone. Two plain sisters would understand each other. They would make common cause together and surely grow to be friends. It was not long before it became obvious this would not happen. By the time they were in their first proper frocks, even Mary could see that they followed not in her footsteps, but in those of Jane and Elizabeth.
"They are handsome little things,"
declared their mother with satisfaction.
"Not quite the equal of Jane, but very pleasing nonetheless. Four beauties out of five is a very respectable number. I'm sure no one could have done better."
As Kitty and Lydia grew older, Mary quickly understood that her younger sisters had as little need of her as the elder two had. Left to herself, Kitty might have weakened. She was a mild, pliable girl, eager to please. She might have been persuaded to be Mary's friend, but the youngest Bennet daughter was determined that would not happen. Even as a child, Lydia was headstrong, bold, and willful. And once she decided she wanted Kitty for herself, Mary was no match for her. It did not take long before Kitty was entirely enthralled to Lydia, dominated by her iron whim, obediently echoing all her opinions. Soon Kitty had as little time for Mary as did anyone else. By the time she was 14, Mary knew she came first with none of her sisters. She was no one's special friend or confidant. Neither her mother nor her father looked on her with any particular affection. In the midst of so large a family, she was utterly alone. Chapter 3. Mrs. Bennet's behaviour only deepened Mary's unhappiness, for the pleasure she took in her four handsome daughters could not, it seemed, entirely make up for the shortcomings of the fifth. And with every year that passed, Mary's appearance irritated her mother more and more. Mrs. Bennet had neither the patience nor the inclination to hide her vexation, which was provoked by a host of small failings. But few frustrated her more than Mary's hair. Each night, at her insistence, it was tied into curl papers, and each morning, as Mrs. Hill brushed it out, it emerged as straight and as fine as before. Mrs. Bennet could not help but regard this daily disappointment as a personal affront.
"Mary, I believe you do this on purpose to annoy me."
"Indeed I don't, Mamma. I would make it curl if I could. Perhaps it could be swept back off my face. Then it might not be noticed that it doesn't curl."
Mrs. Bennet frowned.
"Perhaps you would rather wear a cap like an old married woman. That would cover up a multitude of sins."
With this, her mother would march indignantly away, leaving Mrs. Hill to pick up her combs and brushes again, ready to make another hopeless attempt to achieve the impossible. Soon Mary longed for invisibility. It was better to attract no attention at all than to find herself the object of her mother's peevish displeasure. So she did all she could to disappear, choosing dresses in the most anonymous colours, made up in the most unexceptional styles. When Mrs. Hill, who she knew felt sorry for her, urged her to consider brighter shades and more flattering shapes, she refused. Unremarkable greys and beiges were all she deserved. Convinced that nothing could improve the figure she presented to the world, she took no part in the conversations about hats and shoes and muslins, which, as they grew older, occupied so much of Kitty's and Lydia's time. Lydia was sharp-tongued, as merciless in her judgments as their mother, and Mary feared the scorn she was sure would greet her awkward attempts to join in. It was easier to stay silent. When her sisters walked into Meryton to spend their allowances in the village's small millinery shop, she hovered outside, alone in the street. There was no point in going in. What would she do with a new lace collar, with coloured ribbons or a straw hat? Fripperies of that sort were not for girls like her. Restless and isolated, she sought other ways to occupy her time, but her choices were few. She had no talent for drawing, and needlework bored her. She could not paint, and she disliked cards. Music, however, was a different matter. Seated at the piano, Mary felt almost happy, forgetting for a moment her deficiencies and failures. All the Bennet sisters had been taught to play. Mrs. Bennet considered it a charming skill for a girl to possess, and had insisted that all her daughters acquire it, even providing a teacher for them. The genteel and put-upon Miss Allen arrived every Wednesday afternoon and taught each Bennet daughter one after the other. Mary remembered awaiting her turn, counting the minutes till Lizzie was finished, breathlessly eager to take her place at the keyboard. At first she had been so small that she had required a cushion in order to reach the keys. There she had sat, precariously perched, her child's tiny fingers stretching to perform her scales and arpeggios. She had loved it from the beginning, thrilled by the sounds she produced, excited as week by week they came gradually to resemble tunes and melodies. This was when she was still young, before she had learned to be ashamed of herself. As she absorbed the painful knowledge of her plainness, she had turned her face away from many pursuits she had once enjoyed. But her love for music was one of the few passions Mary did not renounce as she grew older. She continued to play, even as sister after sister gave up, abandoning their piano lessons as quickly as Mrs. Bennet permitted. Soon only Mary and Lizzie troubled the battered family instrument with any regularity. Something, however, had changed. When she began, music was a treat for Mary, an escape from a daily life in which there was precious little to enjoy. But by the time she entered her teens, she no longer looked upon it as merely a diverting pastime. It had slowly dawned on her that once she was seated behind the keyboard, good looks counted for nothing. At the piano, the plainest woman might outshine the prettiest if she had the ambition and single-mindedness required to do so. Although conscious of her shortcomings in so many areas of life, Mary did not doubt her powers of stamina and application. And it struck her they could be harnessed to deliver a sense of purpose and achievement sadly lacking elsewhere in her drab existence. Why should she not direct them towards mastering the piano? She was already competent. With effort, she might become even more accomplished. The prospect of possessing a talent of her own, some mark of distinction, was thrilling to her, and she did not for a moment begrudge the work involved in acquiring it. She willingly exiled herself to the drawing-room, where none but she ventured until tea-time, rehearsing her exercises again and again. She was dogged in her pursuit of perfection, and eventually she was rewarded for it. In all aspects of technique and proficiency, she was soon much improved. Miss Allen declared herself very satisfied with her progress and assured her that if she maintained the habit of regular and rigorous practice, she could expect to get better still. Mary was unused to praise, and this small crumb of encouragement was enough to harden her resolve and tie her to the keyboard for many solitary hours. Mostly, she did not resent the time she spent alone with her exercises. But occasionally, in the midst of her practice, she would find herself overtaken by a sadness she did not understand. It took her a while to grasp that the sensation she felt was one of regret for the pleasure and excitement that had once overwhelmed her when she played. The relentless discipline she had imposed on herself had slowly extinguished all the delight with which she used to approach the piano. Now it was a task like any other. Her hard work and effort had brought her the expertise she longed for, but it had been achieved at the cost of a simple enjoyment she had loved more than any other. Usually, Mary was able to convince herself this had been a price worth paying, that indulging her happiness mattered less than honing her skills. But there were times when she was assailed by doubts about what she had given up. When longing for the fulfillment and release which music had delivered broke through, despite all her attempts to repress it. One morning, as she walked towards the drawing-room to begin her daily practice, music tucked under her arm, she heard the unmistakable sound of Lizzie at the piano. She would have known her style anywhere, fast, full of bravado, so appealing that it was impossible not to turn your head and listen. The few mistakes she made did nothing to mar the pleasure of hearing her. Mary slipped silently into the room and watched her sister as she finished the piece, head tilted back, concluding with a little flourish all her own, added for no other reason than her own satisfaction. Mary sat down, a little stunned by the energy and attack of Elizabeth's treatment of the song. It was nothing like her own precise and exact style, but no one could hear it and not admire it. "That was very good, Lizzie," she exclaimed. "There were hardly any false notes. If you were to practice properly, you might really master it." Her face slightly flushed from the exertion of performing the piece, Elizabeth pushed the stool away from the keyboard as if to signal she had done what she wished to do and would play no more. "That wouldn't suit me at all. I'm not sure I have the patience to master anything. The minute it began to be troublesome, I'd find something else to do." "But don't you want to cultivate your gift? It seems a great shame to waste it." "I'm not sure it is wasted if it pleases me," Lizzie allowed her fingers to trace a simple scale. "I sometimes wonder if you might enjoy yourself more if you applied yourself a little less." "But if I don't apply myself, how will I play anything correctly?" "Perhaps," remarked Lizzie, "correctness and application are not the only measures of success." This was exactly the suspicion that sometimes disturbed Mary's own thoughts. But she pushed the idea away, for it was impossible for her to admit it. "I cannot believe anything worth having is to be achieved without effort and sacrifice." "That may be so," replied Lizzie. "And yet I know I'd rather listen to a piece played with happiness and a spring in its step than to all the well-drilled perfection in the world." "I doubt you'd care to hear a succession of mistakes," retorted Mary, "however cheerful the person was who played them." Elizabeth gathered up her music and rose from the piano. "Possibly, but really, it seems a great shame to wring all the pleasure out of music. A few false notes seem a small price to pay in exchange." She touched Mary's shoulder lightly as she left the room. Mary sat down and assembled her music, but could not settle. Elizabeth's words had agitated her. It was easy for Lizzie to speak slightingly of hard work and effort. Everything came easily to her. She did not need to exert herself. Charm would always see her through, even at the piano. Mary thrust her book of music onto the stand. For her, things were different. She flexed her fingers and began to practice her scales. Chapter 4. When she felt too tired to sit any longer at the keyboard, it was Mary's custom to retreat to her bedroom and read. There she had a small bookcase in which stood the dozen or so books which belonged to her. They were so familiar that she could recite whole passages from them by heart. Nevertheless, it pleased her to open them and look again at the well-remembered words. She could not recall a time when reading had not been both a comfort and a refuge. Indeed, she sometimes thought she remembered the moment when the great joy of literacy had come upon her. She was huddled in front of the fire in the nursery when the black lines on the paper that Lizzie had so patiently traced for her ceased to be random shapes and suddenly assembled themselves into letters. A is for apple, C is for cat. Once she grasped this, there was no holding her back. She raced on, advancing from picture books to rhymes and fairy stories. She made short work of the history of Little Goody Two-Shoes, and the story of the robins did not detain her long. In those days, she read in the company of Jane or Elizabeth, the three of them sitting together up in the nursery, each occupied with her own book in companionable quiet. But as she grew older and more unhappy, and her sisters drifted away from her, books became less a link between them than a solace for their loss. When Jane and Elizabeth whispered together without including her, when they shut the door to their room and did not ask her to join them, then it was to her books that Mary fled, finding in them a distraction from the loneliness that depressed her spirits. She read so much that she quickly exhausted not just her own shelves, but also the scanty resources of the Longbourn schoolroom. Soon she had finished everything it contained, from the atlases of the world to hints on housekeeping. But the more she consumed, the sharper her desire for new reading matter grew. She picked up anything she found about the house, bearing it away to study at her leisure. The novels Mrs. Bennet borrowed from the circulating library occupied her for a while, but their beautiful, imperiled heroines, their handsome, upright heroes, and the complications of the plot that brought them step by convoluted step to the most improbable happy endings did not please her. She condemned them as silly and longed for more demanding fare. Thinking she might prefer fact to fiction, she picked up Mr. Bennet's newspapers, squinting at their tiny black print, spelling out to herself the unfamiliar names and places they described, until her eyes hurt and she laid them aside. She read the agricultural magazines to which she subscribed, puzzling at the images of threshing machines and diagrams of crop rotations. She spirited away the pamphlets brought into the house by the servants, with their lurid accounts of horrible crimes and dying confessions, studying the crude black line drawings of hanged men and murdered women until Mrs. Hill discovered them and carried them angrily off to the kitchen. Sometimes she happened upon more substantial volumes left about by Mr. Bennet, and these she would regard with great curiosity, but she did not dare to open them. Her father's books were sacrosanct, and not to be meddled with by anyone but himself. Mary was 18 when she understood she could not go on in this haphazard way. She longed to develop her intellectual understanding, just as she had done her musical proficiency. But she understood that to do so, two things were necessary. First, she needed to consult a far greater range of reading material. And second, she required the assistance of a teacher. She had Miss Allen for the piano. Why should she not have similar support in pursuing her intellectual interests? Surely some steady, learned person could be found to direct her reading and give a shape to her studies. If she had been a boy, a tutor would have been provided for her. But such a thing was unthinkable for a girl. Nor was there any chance of her being sent away to school, as it was an article of faith with Mrs. Bennet that the food served to boarders was stodgy and damaged the complexion. There was only one possible answer to Mary's dilemma, and that was the appointment of a governess. But it was many months before she summoned up the courage to ask her mother if this might be permitted. She approached the subject gingerly, as she knew Mrs. Bennet did not look kindly upon governesses, Indeed, it was a matter of pride to her mother that she had never employed such a person. A succession of masters had, over the years, marched up the drive to Longbourn to instruct her daughters in those subjects she thought would add a final polish to their education. From them, she and her sisters had gleaned a smattering of French, a little drawing, and a great deal of dancing. But in matters of general education, Mrs. Bennet considered her own example, supplemented by a respectable number of textbooks, as enough to equip them with all they needed to know. She had taught her girls how to cast up accounts, manage a household, and sew a good straight seam. They all read well enough, and knew enough history and geography not to look absolutely foolish in company. Anything more was not only unnecessary, but probably unwise. Mrs. Bennet had not observed that learning was a quality most men sought in a wife, and she had no desire to add to her daughter's disadvantages by burdening them with a reputation for cleverness. All this Mary knew, but the desire to exercise her mind overcame her apprehension, and one afternoon, as she sat with her mother and sisters at tea, she made her request as boldly and as calmly as she could. Mrs. Bennet was nonplussed, as Mary had expected she would be.
A governess? Whatever can you mean? What could you possibly want with one at your age?
I should like to improve my education, Mamma, to read more widely and cultivate my mind.
I cannot imagine what else you think you need to learn, cried Mrs. Bennet. Your head is stuffed full of useless facts already. I doubt there's a country in the world whose capital you don't know, or whose principal rivers you couldn't name. What more could a governess teach you?
She could help me study in a more rational way, direct me towards books that would stretch my intellect. Mary felt enthusiasm quicken within her. And she need not only work with me, she could be of service to all us younger girls. I'm sure we'd all benefit from improving our habits of industry. Lydia, who usually paid no attention to anything Mary said, started up, horrified.
Heaven preserve me from the habits of industry, and my mind is stretched quite enough, thank you. The last thing we need is a governess sitting in the morning room sniffing and looking miserable. Some poor spinster with a book of sermons in one hand and a twist of snuff in the other.
She turned to Kitty, held an imaginary pinch of snuff under her nose, snorted, turned up her eyes and groaned. Kitty burst out laughing, scattering crumbs from her cake across the table.
I can't imagine anything more awful, declared Lydia. And Kitty thinks the same, I'm sure. It would be dreadful, especially the sniffing, added Kitty obediently. Please, Mamma, don't do it. We're happy as we are.
I'm sure we could find someone we all liked, persisted Mary. Some well-bred woman with no annoying habits, and she need only come a few times a week.
Oh, that's still far too often for me, said Lydia. Suppose she doesn't come at all?
Mary ignored her, fixing her mother with a supplicant stare. Really, Mamma, when you consider the benefits to our minds. But it was no use. Mrs. Bennet had already made her decision.
That's enough, Mary. No one else wants a governess, and I refuse to entertain the expense of one solely for your benefit. If you wish to learn more, that is your affair. There are books enough in Mr. Bennet's library. You may take yourself off there, as Lizzie does, and read to your heart's content. That is all I have to say upon the matter. I don't wish to hear it mentioned again.
Lydia, much relieved, helped herself to another slice of cake. Mary knew it was pointless to say more. But as she sat there, watching her tea grow cold, the significance of her mother's words slowly dawned upon her. It had never before occurred to her that she might be allowed to enter her father's library. She often looked into it as she passed, a light and airy room with bay windows that opened directly onto the garden, a vision of scholarly calm. Its real attractions, however, were the books which lined its walls, shelf after shelf of them, a tantalizing vision for a hungry reader desperate for something new to engage her. Mr. Bennet spent most of every day there, closeted in a most forbidding silence. Interlopers, as he liked to remind his family, were not encouraged to join him.
As I do not quarrel with the general air of silliness that pervades every other part of this house, I do not think it unreasonable that there should be one room from which it is excluded.
Neither Kitty nor Lydia, for whom the bookshelves offered no temptation, were troubled by this pronouncement. Nor was Mrs. Bennet. She had no curiosity about how her husband spent his time in his library, and it would not have occurred to her to try to find out. Only Elizabeth slipped in now and then to borrow a book with the same easy confidence which characterized everything she did. But Lizzie was Mr. Bennet's favourite, and his usually sardonic gaze often rested upon her with a warmth and admiration he did not extend to his younger daughters. Mary had never supposed a similar welcome would ever be offered to her. Mr. Bennet rarely looked at her at all, and seemed quite indifferent to her presence. She would never have considered the possibility of entering the library if her mother had not suggested it. But now the prospect of roaming freely among so many books overcame her fear of a refusal. She plucked up her courage and waited until she judged her father was in his least capricious frame of mind before stopping him in the hallway and asking, very tentatively, if she might be granted admission on the same terms as Lizzie. He considered for a moment before replying.
You may come and take refuge in my library if you feel you will benefit from it, but you are to remember it is not a place for conversation. I will not be teased with idle questions. A rational calm is to prevail at all times, and every book taken down from a shelf is to be returned to the exact place from which it was removed. These rules are inflexible. Do you think you can obey them?
Yes, sir, I do.
Then I have no objection to your coming. You may begin tomorrow.
Chapter 5. Next morning, Mary hurried through her usual tasks, desperate to be released from her mother's watchful eye. Her plain sewing seemed to take even longer than usual, her needle losing its thread countless times, whilst Mrs. Bennet insisted two uneven hems were to be unpicked and done again. But finally she found herself standing outside the library door, daring herself to enter. Once inside, she held her breath, amazed to be within at last. Mr. Bennet was at his accustomed place behind his desk. He acknowledged her curtly and returned to his work. As she looked about, Mary was both thrilled and apprehensive. She had imagined that she would have no difficulty in finding what she wanted, but standing in a shaft of sunlight in which dust motes shimmered, she realized she did not know what she was looking for or where to begin. She moved to a shelf and leant towards the books, peering to make out their titles. Carefully, she pulled one out. Immediately, two volumes at the end of the row clattered onto the floor. The noise seemed huge, shattering the quiet. Mr. Bennet looked up. Panicked, Mary grasped the two books nearest to her and hurried away. In the hall, she stood clasping them tightly to her chest. This was not how she had imagined her first visit ending. When she felt more composed, she bore her prizes off to her bedroom and sat down to examine them. Opening the first volume, she saw it was a history of England. She was not sure whether this pleased her or not, but when she looked more closely, she discovered it was written by a woman. This surprised her. She knew that women produced books for children and that they also wrote novels, but she had not supposed they were ever the authors of serious works of history. She was intrigued and walked over to her little writing desk, where she cleared a space and propped up the book in front of her. She would give Mrs. Catherine Macaulay a chance to engage her. Mary was still in her room when Mrs. Hill came in to find her and send her down for dinner.
Your mother has been calling for you for 10 minutes. She's not best pleased.
Mary looked up absently, laid down her book, and then walked slowly downstairs. She hardly spoke during the meal, her thoughts entirely occupied by what she had read. It was not as easy to follow as the simpler works she was used to, but that did not discourage her. On the contrary, she felt the unused muscles of her mind flex and curiosity stir within her. It took her a fortnight to finish Mrs. Macaulay's first volume. When she returned to Mr. Bennet's library, she looked to see if there were any other history books written by women. When she found none, she was absurdly disappointed. Her searching hand hesitated for a moment over Mr. Hume's historical works, but she did not pick one of them off the shelf. No, she would continue with Mrs. Macaulay before venturing upon anyone else. She took away two more volumes of hers, excited to think that a woman had acquired enough knowledge and scholarship to produce them. Over the next few weeks, she devoured them avidly, waking early to study them in the morning before breakfast and returning to them late at night when the rest of the house slept. She begrudged every minute she was forced out of their company and into those activities her mother thought necessary, fidgeting through the hours spent at the tea table or wasted in useful needlework. Mrs. Bennet noticed her distraction and did not approve.
"You are never to be found when wanted, and when you are about, you don't attend to anything said to you."
Mary apologized and vowed to do better in future, but she knew her promise was a hollow one. Her life, such as it was, now took place almost entirely between the pages of her books. The events of the Civil Wars, as Mrs. Macaulay explained them, the stories of Charles I and Oliver Cromwell, had become more real to her than the days which passed so unchangingly at Longbourn. Her books were her mainstay, and nothing, not even her mother's loudly expressed displeasure, could make her give them up. On the contrary, her intellectual appetite grew more intense with each volume she finished. And as a consequence, her visits to her father's library grew ever more frequent and of longer and longer duration. She explored Mr. Bennet's bookshelves with greater confidence now, venturing to look beyond the historical titles that were increasingly familiar to her, gazing curiously towards works of philosophy and theology. Dare she take one of those? She was not sure. They seemed more forbidding than the histories. And with which author should she begin? She was desperate for guidance, and often looked longingly towards her father, hoping he might notice and offer to advise her. But he showed no interest in the books she chose, never asking what she was reading or how she had enjoyed it. For a while, she watched him from beneath lowered eyes, trying to assess how he would respond if she were to approach him. But in the end, her spirits failed her. She could not imagine how she would begin, or, once he turned his cool, satirical stare upon her, how she would continue. So she went on as she had begun, with nothing but her own judgment to rely upon. The weeks turned into months, and Mary read on and on. Jane and Lizzie watched her with puzzled indulgence, glad to see her occupied, though unsure what to make of her new passion. But for her younger sisters, Mary's devotion to her books lowered her even further in their estimation. There was much whispering and laughter amongst them whenever they found her at her studies, and Lydia had soon perfected an imitation of her at work, her shoulders hunched, her nose plunged deep into some heavy volume. But Mary was not deterred. She felt herself to be making progress, and refused to be either teased or shamed into giving up. She had at last plucked up the courage to begin upon some of the shorter philosophical books, and was intrigued by what she discovered within them. She found the great moral questions with which they dealt intensely absorbing, enjoying the abstract arguments with which they dealt. In contrast to their lofty concerns, her private unhappiness seemed of very little account, and this offered her a rather chilly sense of comfort. She was both stimulated and consoled by what she read, and this encouraged her to persevere. Learning, it seemed, was not so different to playing the piano. The mind could be trained to do one's bidding, just as one's fingers could be exercised and one's technique improved. All it took was self-discipline and a willingness to work hard. But Mary soon discovered, to her cost, that there were some circumstances which even her formidable determination could not overcome, and that not all aspects of her being could be coerced into doing exactly what she wished. She had suspected for some time that her sight was not all it should be, but had refused to acknowledge the evidence that pressed itself upon her with increasing urgency. Small print had always taxed her abilities, but now, perhaps as a result of her many hours in the library, almost any book had become impossible to read. The text swam before her, the words blurred. She tried screwing her eyes tight to focus as best she could, but it made little difference. She tried moving around the room, tilting the book towards the light, or holding it as close as she could to her face, but nothing answered. In the glare of a summer's garden, she might manage a page or two if the sun was behind her and the letters not too small. But indoors, as the darker nights came on, she struggled to make out anything at all. One evening, as she sat at her desk, she realized she could barely see a single line of her book. She lit one candle, then another, placing them as close as she dared to the pages, but it made no difference. She was so angry that she felt she might scream. It seemed monstrously unfair that just as she had discovered an interest that gave her life meaning, it should be taken away from her. If she could not read, what was left to her? She closed the book carefully, with a calm she did not feel, and lay on her bed, trying to decide what she must do. For 2 days, Mary attempted to live without books. She played the piano, walked in the garden, picked flowers for the drawing room, and pretended to sew. By the afternoon of the second day, she knew that for her, such an existence was unendurable. If she was not to go mad, she must ask her mother if she might consult an oculist. This was not a request to be undertaken lightly. Mary knew it was likely to provoke Mrs. Bennet to even greater heights of indignation than her attempts to secure a governess. For what could be more destructive of her skimpy attractions than the wearing of heavy metal spectacles? But Mary had no choice. If the alternative was impossible, the question must be asked. All she could do was to approach her mother when she was at her least peevish, throwing herself as boldly as she could upon Mrs. Bennet's uncertain sympathies. Mary finally approached her mother one afternoon when she was occupied in the pantry, checking the bottled fruit that had been put up last autumn, peering into the jars to see if the plums, apricots, and greengages were still good. As this was a task she enjoyed, Mrs. Bennet was tolerably cheerful until Mary explained why she had come to see her. Then her good mood evaporated, and she professed not to credit what she was being asked.
"I cannot believe you are serious. If this is a joke, Mary, it's in very poor taste."
"It is no joke, Mamma, I promise you. I can hardly see to read. I do beg I might be allowed to have my eyes examined."
"To what end? How do you think that will help?"
"If the oculist thinks I would benefit from it, he could prescribe spectacles, and then I should be able to read again."
"Spectacles, indeed! And you would really be prepared to wear them? To humiliate yourself in such a way?"
"If they allowed me to read as I wish, then yes, I would be happy to wear them." Mrs. Bennet, who had just lifted a large jar of apricots down from the shelf, deposited it onto the table with a little too much vigour. Fortunately, it did not break, but the noise made Mary jump.
"No man will look at you," she declared. "And every woman will pity you."
"I hope I will be equal to bearing that, if I must." For a moment, Mrs. Bennet was speechless, unable to conceive of such a crime against everything she held dear. But Mary steeled herself to continue. "If you don't feel able to help me, then I will pay for it myself. I have a little money saved from my allowance. I will write to the oculist myself and ask him to call." Her mother wiped her hands on her apron.
"Then it seems I have no choice in the matter. Let the oculist come, if he must. But I am very displeased with you, Mary. I am sadly vexed and agitated now, and it's all your fault."
She strode towards the door, so angry that she left the jars still on the table, untouched and unexamined.
"Don't think I will attend you when he comes. Mrs. Hill will take care of it. I would not be equal to the strain of it all."
Left alone in the room, Mary's hands shook as she picked up the jar of apricots and placed it carefully back on the shelf. She did not think she had ever defied her mother so openly before. She sat down heavily, but she had achieved her object. She would see an oculist. She only hoped it would be soon. Chapter 6. A week later, Mr. Sparrow, a large man in a snuff-coloured coat, presented himself at Longbourn. He brought with him a large portfolio containing a number of printed cards, a large, stiff leather case, and his son, John, a tall, silent boy of 18.
"I hope you won't object to his presence, miss. He is learning the business, and I try to take him with me to see as much of it as he can at first hand."
Mary looked uncertain. She had not imagined their proceedings would involve a spectator. However, young Mr. Sparrow looked polite and respectful, so she nodded a silent assent. Mrs. Hill ushered them into the chilly morning room, where no welcoming fire was lit in the grate, and stood against the wall to watch what happened next.
"If you please to sit in this chair, miss, as straight as you can. Head upright, eyes ahead. Yes, that will do very well."
He beckoned to his son, who brought the case to his father's side and opened it with a slow, reverential gesture. Inside were row after row of spectacles, neatly labelled and in perfect order.
"Now, miss," explained Mr. Sparrow, "each of these pairs contains a different lens. I shall ask you to put them on one by one. John will give you a card to look at, and you will tell me what you see. Then I shall try another, and you will look again and say if the characters on the cards appear more or less clearly as a result. Thus we will go on until we find the right spectacles for you."
Mary's apprehension grew as she felt the cold metal frame slide onto her nose, but Mr. Sparrow's low, confident tones calmed her, and she began to feel a flicker of interest in his careful, practiced methods. When she looked at the card through the first spectacles, she was so astonished to see how it distorted the letters that surprise broke through her shyness and she cried out loud,
"Sir, I can't make out anything at all. Just shapes and blurs. What does it mean?"
"It means it is not the answer we are looking for, although it points us towards where we need to go."
He gave her another pair, and this time Mary thought the letters were a little clearer. Again and again they tried, with results that were sometimes a little better and sometimes a little worse. Despite herself, she grew so absorbed in the process that her self-consciousness melted away. She began to think of herself less as Mr. Sparrow's patient and more as his ally, helping him as he tried to find the answer to her problem. At last, he placed a pair upon her nose that made her gasp in amazement. Suddenly, every letter on the card appeared bright and sharp.
"Oh, Mr. Sparrow, I can see every character on the cards as clear as anything. Every letter, every number, I can see it all."
"Ah, so that's the one then," Mr. Sparrow said with a laugh. "It is always pleasing to see so very definite a reaction. I think we may be confident that we have found the answer. This small object," he said, leaning over and removing the lens from the frame, "when properly prepared, will, I am certain, make the most extraordinary difference to your life."
"It really is the most remarkable thing, sir. Can you tell me how it works?"
"Well, perhaps I may ask John to explain to you. Then I can see how much of what I've been teaching him has taken firm root in his mind. John, if you please."
The young man was shy and hesitant at first, but he knew his business and gained steadily in confidence as he described the delicate curvature of the lens, its transforming impact upon an individual eye, and the care and precision with which it must be ground if it was to correct defective sight.
"I am learning to do that myself and should be very pleased, honoured, to have had a hand in making a lens for you."
He caught her eye as he finished, then stared at his feet, as if he had said too much. His father patted his arm, proud of his boy.
"We shall do it together and make an excellent job of it. I venture to suggest, miss, that you will be extremely pleased with the result."
Mary looked away, unused to finding herself the object of so much attention. It was, however, not unpleasing. It was impossible to be offended by these quiet, exacting men, their minds fixed so intently upon the challenges of their profession. As she handed back the little frame, she turned towards them and smiled. Mrs. Hill walked over to join them, and for a moment they all stood together, happy with what they had achieved. Then Mary heard her mother's footsteps in the hall, and her face fell.
"So, Mr. Sparrow," cried Mrs. Bennet as she strode into the room, "what have you to tell me?"
The oculist attempted to explain his findings and his opinion of Mary's sight, but Mrs. Bennet waved him away, impatient.
That is all very well, sir. But may we come to the point? Are you telling me that my daughter will have to wear spectacles?
Why, yes, ma'am, I believe so. I do not think she can with ease perform any close work without them. For all occupations where acute sight is needed, they will be essential.
But she need not wear them outside the house. They could be dispensed with in public or in any place where people might see her.
That must be for the young lady herself to judge, but I am sure she would derive great benefit from being able to see properly in any situation, public or private.
Mrs. Bennet frowned.
Thank you, Mr. Sparrow. You may write to Mr. Bennet, who will inform you of what we decide to do. Good morning to you.
She gestured to Mrs. Hill to show the Sparrows out. Mary watched as they were ushered away, regretting she had not been able to thank them as they deserved. Once they had gone, her mother turned towards her, indignant.
This is very disappointing news, Mary. It is not at all what I had hoped for.
Mary said nothing. She had no wish to anger her mother further.
We shall go and speak to your father about it directly. Let us hear what he has to say.
They walked to the drawing-room in silence. When they arrived, Mrs. Bennet threw open the door, and Mary was sorry to see that the whole family were gathered there. She had hoped to avoid the embarrassment of hearing her situation discussed in front of everyone, but that was evidently impossible. With a loud sigh, Mrs. Bennet sat down. Jane and Lizzie looked up from their reading. Kitty and Lydia turned away from the gloves they were examining. Only their father did not respond, determinedly studying his newspaper. Finally, Mrs. Bennet could remain silent no longer.
Mr. Bennet, I have something to tell you. I'm afraid it's very provoking news. Would you like to know what it is?
Mr. Bennet lowered his paper and looked over it evenly at his wife.
Whatever my wishes in the matter, I'm sure you intend to tell me.
Mary needs spectacles. The oculist says she cannot see without them. There, Mr. Bennet.
She looked about her with the consciousness of having delivered a very significant and troubling piece of information. It was Elizabeth who spoke first.
Surely, Mama, it is good to know what can be done to help Mary. If she needs spectacles, ought she not to have them? It must be very hard for her to struggle on without them if she cannot see as well as she should.
Mrs. Bennet uttered a stricken little cry.
Really, Lizzie, what can you mean? It is a dreadful misfortune for her. Spectacles are for doddering old men, not for young girls of 18. I refuse to believe that she really needs them. No one in my family has ever been so afflicted before. We gardeners all have perfect sight.
But, Mama, continued Elizabeth, you do so little close work and read so rarely that you may not know whether you need them or not.
How can you say such a thing? No one enjoys a book more than I do. Read so rarely indeed.
You are forgetting, my dear, that I myself wear glasses, added Mr. Bennet. I should not like to think of myself as an old man, doddering or otherwise, but I admit I should be quite incapable of study without them.
You are teasing me, Mr. Bennet, but you know the truth of what I say. A man may wear spectacles, I suppose, even a young man, especially if he's a lawyer or a clergyman or such like, and no one will speak ill of him. For a young woman it is quite a different thing. What do you think people will say when they see Mary in them? Who will want to marry her then?
Mr. Bennet looked thoughtful.
Perhaps one of those very men you have just described will offer for her, a wearer of spectacles himself, boldly indifferent to the scorn of all the neighbourhood. Indeed, it may be the very thing that brings them together.
You are pleased to make a joke of it, but it is no laughing matter. The oculist says she needs spectacles to read, but why, I might ask, does she need to read so many books?
At this, Elizabeth tried to interrupt, but her father held up his hand.
If Mary is not to read, what other occupations are open to her? She has no taste for drawing. And, as you have so often informed me, her sewing is a great disappointment to you. I am no expert, but it seems to me that her skills with a needle are unlikely to improve if she cannot see to thread it.
I suppose she might help dig the garden when the winter cabbages come in.
Back and forth the conversation went, over Mary's silent head. No one expected her to say anything. Instead, she allowed herself to concentrate on Elizabeth's kind words. It had been a long time since she had heard Lizzie speak about her with such concern. She knew better, however, than to expect any sympathy from her youngest sister.
"I think I should rather be blind than put such ugly things onto my face," exclaimed Lydia. "Giving up books would be a small price to pay to avoid that dreadful fate. What is there to be learned from reading, anyway?"
Mr. Bennet looked at Lydia with an expression of steady disapproval.
"It is remarks of that sort which have won you the reputation of being one of the vainest, and, I might add, one of the most foolish and empty-headed girls in the neighbourhood."
"As long as I am not also one of the ugliest, I really do not care, Papa."
Mrs. Hill arrived, bearing a fresh pot of coffee, just in time to hear Lydia's disobliging remark. When Lydia saw her, she held up her cup, hopefully, but Mrs. Hill seemed not to notice, and carried the pot as far away from her as possible, at the far end of the table where she offered it to Mr. Bennet.
"Thank you, Lydia," he declared, as Mrs. Hill filled his cup. "Nothing could have made clearer for me the right choice in this matter. I will not stand in the way of any member of this family who seeks to diminish the amount of stupidity in this house. Mary, if you wish to read, you shall have the wherewithal to do so. You shall have your spectacles."
Mrs. Bennet looked as though she was about to argue, but her husband had heard enough.
"No, my dear, there's an end to it. I will not be plagued on the subject any longer. I shall be in the library until dinner time, and I do not expect to be disturbed."
Mary sat for a moment, trying not to let her relief and satisfaction show. She could not remember when she had felt more pleased. Her mother would not look at her as she stood up, but Mary did not mind it. There was almost a spring in her step as she walked out of the drawing room. It was some weeks before Mr. Sparrow wrote to say that the spectacles were ready and that he would be pleased to wait upon Mrs. Bennet at her convenience. Mary's mother, who considered she had done all in her power to prevent this great embarrassment, declined to be present and again sent Mrs. Hill in her stead, with instructions to ensure no sharp practice was attempted at the final moment. Once the little group was reassembled and Mary was seated straight-backed in her chair, Mr. Sparrow directed his son to open the leather bag he carried. The young man pulled from within a pair of spectacles, wrapped in a soft cloth, which he presented to Mary with a dignified flourish. Mary put them on, picked up a book from the table, opened it, and exclaimed with pleasure as the print leapt into sharp focus.
"Look, Mrs. Hill! I can read perfectly now!"
Mrs. Hill crossed her arms over her chest and stared at her assessingly. "Well, I'm very glad of it, but I'm not sure what your mother will say." In an instant, Mary's pleasure vanished. She took off the spectacles and placed them in her lap. She had forgotten for a moment the price she must pay for her crisp, fresh vision of the world. Lydia's scorn rang in her ears. She might see things more clearly now, but she would appear even plainer as a result.
"Oh, no, please don't do that, miss."
She was astonished to see John Sparrow cross the room and take the spectacles from her.
"Don't allow yourself to be cast down. It's a wonderful thing to see properly, not to have to peer about and screw up one's face."
He polished the lenses with a little cloth, intent on his task. "And really, you look very well in them. When you smile, you look very well." He handed them back to her with a small bob of his head before hurrying back to stand alongside his father again.
"John is quite right," agreed Mr. Sparrow, "on both points. And once you have worn them often enough, neither you nor anyone else will take any notice of them. Of that you can be quite sure."
Mary doubted her mother would agree, but she could not bring herself to contradict this kindly, well-meaning man.
"Thank you, Mr. Sparrow. I'm sure you are right. I think they will suit me excellently, and I shall take the greatest pleasure in wearing them."
She took the spectacles in her hand and went out into the hall. As she closed the door, it seemed as though John Sparrow's gaze followed her across the room.
but when she thought about it, she knew she must be mistaken. She stood for a moment, listening to Mrs. Hill discussing how and when the sparrows should be paid. Then she collected her thoughts and walked quickly away. She should go and try out her spectacles on the last volume of Mrs. Macaulay.